support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night, four more men's basketball teams advanced into the Great Eight in the St. Louis region. Kansas overwhelmed the University of Alabama 100-74. Kansas star Wayne Simeon had 30 points, 9 rebounds, and 5 assists. In the much closer late game, Georgia Tech lost its most effective offensive player, B.J. Elder, to an ankle injury early, but still managed to cool off Nevada in the second half and beat the Wolfpack 72-67. In the Atlanta region's early game, form failed to prevail as number 7 seed Xavier beat number 3 seed Texas 79-71. Later, Duke, a number 1 seed, led Illinois by only one at the half, but eventually triumphed 72-62. Later in the program, Charlie Pierce will preview the women's Sweet 16 round, in which play begins today. The acquisition of A-Rod, a.k.a. Alex Rodriguez, by the Yankees after the Red Sox publicly pursued the alleged best player in baseball has overshadowed a lot of what the other Major League Baseball teams have been doing to improve themselves over the winter. The Angels of Anaheim may be set to render irrelevant what the Yankees and Red Sox have accomplished. Joining us now on the line from Arizona, where the Angels are playing their final week of spring training, is Bill Plaschke of the Los Angeles Times. Bill, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back.
Well, make the case that the Angels had the best offseason of anybody.
You know, I shouldn't have to make the case. It's such an East Coast bias in this country. The Red Sox fans should have to make the case that they've had a better offseason. But, in fact, the Angels truly have. They added, during the offseason, they added baseball's best free agent hitter in Vladimir Guerrero. They added baseball's best free agent pitcher in Bartolo Colon. They added a 30-homer great defensive outfielder in Jose Guillen. And they added a 200-inning starter in Kelvin Escobar. So they added these four players, plus they added these to the nucleus of a team that won the World Series in 2002. People out here think that the Angels have every bit of a chance of winning, you know, going to the World Series this year, plus the fact that they proved a couple years ago they're not scared of the Yankees. And I think even though I think the Red Sox have probably the best team in the American League, I think until they can get to the World Series, you have to say that the Angels would be favorite against them because they've been there and they've shown no fear.
You spoke about the East Coast bias, the bias at least to people to pay more attention to the East Coast teams. But my goodness, there's some people out in Southern California who aren't too bad at promotion. I mean, this is the land of public relations. What's going on?
Well, I know, but when it comes to the sports world, it's amazing. When it comes to the sports world, things seem to revolve a lot of times around the East Coast. And again, the Angels have been really one of those teams that's just been lost in the whole shuffle of everything. And also, you talk about promotion. It's a very good point you make. The Angels, while they play in what seems to be Hollywood, they really aren't in Hollywood. You know, they're a full hour drive south of Hollywood. So they're not really, they're in L.A., but they're not really in L.A. Mm-hmm. And this is one other thing the Angels have tried to address this offseason is they tried to move into Los Angeles with advertising in Los Angeles County on buses and billboards and commercials that, you know, speak of their wanting to get to kind of steal the Dodger fan from L.A.
Have they had any success? Because that was going to be my next question. The Dodgers, of course, have captured hearts and minds for many decades out there. So are the Angels making some serious inroads?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and that's a question I think marketers and sports economists all over the country are going to be following this summer. Right now, we don't know. After the 2002 World Series, you thought the Angels would have made some big strides. Yet, and indeed, last year, they drew over 3 million people for the first time in their franchise history. However, the only landmark that counts is they were still outdrawn by the Dodgers. It was only by several thousand, but the Dodgers still drew more fans. Could this be the year it changes over? I mean, fans are thinking so because they've done great things demographically. They have, as you know, Pro Sports is only Latino owner, and it may or may not have been a coincidence. all four of their big signees this year, their main language is Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in fact, they said Vladimir Guerrero and Bartolo Colon, who's the hitter and the pitcher that were the best of them on the free agent crop, they both said that a key to sign here was that this was an owner they could pick up the phone and talk to, which I think teams, you know, markets and teams everywhere need to be more aware of. This is the fastest growing demographic in this country, is Latino demographic, and I think that that's what the Angels are very aware of and are making great strides in.
Well, now, do we expect that that the Angels, with their new lineup, will get off to a rousing and fast start and make everybody forget all this business about Red Sox and Yankees early
no.
in April?
You know that. I wish. But let's face it, as a longtime West Coast guy and a West Coast advocate, I do admit that the Red Sox-Yankees is one of the greatest rivalries in sports history. It's a wonderful thing to watch. So, no, people are never going to forget about that. Are you kidding? That's still going to be great. It is just my hope that the Angels will, you know, get off to a good start, make enough noise, and be there in October like they were 2 years ago when they stunned the Yankees, and give them that kind of run for their money so the world can once again be reminded that there is more to baseball than just the Northeast and Steinbrenner versus, you know, the morning Red Sox fans who haven't won a thing in, you know, 86 years.
Bill Plaschke covers baseball, among other things, for the Los Angeles Times. Bill, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much, sir.
Adam Hizdu has tried and failed to make a Major League opening day roster 14 times. Still, he hopes 15 will be the charm this spring. Though the Red Sox are loaded in the outfield, the recent announcement that right fielder Trot Nixon may be on the injured list well into May has the 32-year-old Hizdu hopeful that he can stick with the club. Hizdu graciously agreed to lug a recorder to Fort Myers, Florida, which is where we catch up with him on the verge of a doubleheader and a visit from his family.
What an interesting day. Today I got asked if I'll play a 1 o'clock, 7 o'clock doubleheader, split doubleheader. Like there's any question, of course I'll do that. What are you going to say, no, I don't feel like playing? Yeah. So today was pretty smooth. My best batting practice yet. And so the final leg to getting my condo organized, or our condo, you know, our step out on the limb, let's try and make an investment, you know, rental property, that type of thing. So all I needed to do when I get down here was get a mattress. Well, the guy we buy it from ties it onto our roof. 3 minutes into the trip, at about 20 miles an hour, we hear this. There goes the mattress in the rearview mirror, box springs in the median. Meanwhile, some guy in a company truck runs over the mattress. So I'm out in the middle of these lanes trying to direct people not to run us over while this guy tries to tug the mattress out from underneath his truck, which of course he can't because he weighs about 103 pounds. So I have to go over there and throw my butt around. But nonetheless, this kind of goes to my motto. If it's not one thing, it's two. This is the first night in a week that I haven't had company actually stay in the condo. Not that I'm a great entertainer. But nonetheless, you can get more work done because this place is a disaster. Until we meet again. It's Thursday night. Had our first game tonight. Good news, bad news. Three good at-bats, but no hits. You know, you get taught all you can do is put the ball in play and put the ball in play hard. And so, I did that. But in the end, no one remembers hard-hit balls. They just saw you're hitting what you're hitting. I could have felt terrible and had a couple bloop hits and be hitting 500 right now, and instead I'm hitting zero. With having hit the ball great three times. It's just an interesting game. Today, the family arrives.
Hi, my name's Alexa.
And they're very excited to see their father, which is nice. Snapshot into the media circus today. The Yankees came to Fort Myers to play the Boston Red Sox. It was unbelievable. The place was sold out. Beyond that, tickets were being sold and scalped for $500. Unreal. I can't begin to understand the passion and depth that goes into this rivalry. The excitement for the first couple innings was neat. You know, the family went to the beach, enjoyed it, enjoyed the heck out of it. Played 8 innings today, 2 walks, single with an RBI. So it was a pretty good day offensively, on base 3 times. It's good to get a couple hits. Kind of takes the edge off a little bit, you know, because the longer you go without a hit, you want to get an address, you know, you want to get some numbers by your name, so to speak. 7 p.m. game against the Reds tonight. Wow, what a night. A couple good plays in the outfield, but it's nice to hit too, because if you don't hit, you won't be around very long. Wednesday, March 10th, we travel to Jupiter, Florida to play the Cardinals, which is a 6:45 a.m. bus. If you had your choice, you wouldn't do 6 hours of driving to pinch run. But, you know, I got to play in a Major League Baseball game. So, what are you going to complain about? So just suck it up, Adam. Thursday the 11th against Baltimore. I made the last out of the game, the strikeout. That's like always the worst. There's 27 outs. You just don't want to be the last one, you know? I thought I'd have a better at-bat than that. So, just trying to stay positive, keep working through it, with the anticipation that things will work out for the best. Hopefully that the reward would be for the hardworking guy with a good attitude and who can help a team win. And hopefully that's me.
We'll continue to follow Adam Heisdew as the April 4th cut date draws near. It's 18 minutes past the hour. The most popular horse in Japan, an 8-year-old named Glorious Spring, has yet to win a race. That, say the many fans of Glorious Spring, is the horse's attraction. The filly, who has finished somewhere other than first in 106 straight races, has become such a popular wager that she sometimes goes off as the favorite. Her near-legendary lack of speed has inspired Japanese fans to treasure their losing tickets as tokens of good luck, which help them to avoid traffic accidents. Shinji Yoshida, a 54-year-old regular at the track in Tokyo, claims that the popularity of Glorious Spring stems from, quote, Japanese appreciation for the weak and the troubled during recent economic hard times. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the name-clearing campaign by two Midwesterners convinced that 1919 Black Sox member Buck Weaver should not have been banished from baseball. But first, earlier this week, Russia's Evgeny Plyshenko won the gold medal at the World Figure Skating Championships in Dortmund, Germany. There, the American men failed to medal for the first time in 10 years. After yesterday's ladies' short program, Sasha Cohen is in first place. Japanese skaters Shizuka Arakawa and Miki Ando are second and third, respectively. Michelle Kwan is in fourth place. The decisive ladies' free program will be held today. The definitive image of the 2002 Winter Olympics is two couples standing side by side. Each of the four athletes holds a gold medal. The athletes are David Pelletier and Jamie Soleil of Canada, and Yelena Barizhnaya and Anton Sikarulidze of Russia. The circumstances that led to the awarding of two sets of gold medals for pairs figure skating at the Salt Lake City Games figure prominently in a new book entitled The Second Mark, Courage, Corruption, and the Battle for Olympic Gold. Joy Goodwin is the author of that book, and she joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Ms. Goodwin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
The second mark provides an extraordinary amount of background about the Canadian and Russian pair skaters who won the gold medals and about the Chinese team as well, Shen Shuwei and Zhao Hongbo. How did you come to know so much about the backgrounds of the skaters?
Well, I did extensive research. I actually traveled to Russia, China, and the French-speaking and English-speaking parts of Canada to do research for this book and met with the athletes, their families, their coaches. Also, I was behind the scenes for many of the important competitions when I worked as a reporter for ABC Sports backstage.
In that capacity, you were familiar, of course, with the world of figure skating, but were you surprised as you went to work on this book to learn how hard these particular Chinese skaters had worked as small children?
Yes, I found it shocking, actually, to go to China and meet with members of the skating teams from the 50s who actually were prevented from training during the Cultural Revolution. And so there was this big gap in Chinese sports history where athletes were actually at labor camps and couldn't practice their sports. When they came back in 1980, China decided to re-enter the Olympic movement. And then at that point, they started building from scratch. And we're talking no indoor ice rinks in the entire country. A handful of coaches, and a lot of very determined young people who would train in negative 40-degree weather for up to 6 or 8 hours a day.
There's one particular moment where you describe one of the skaters, Shen Shuwei, standing with her feet in her skates and frozen blood between her toes, either because her skates don't fit or her blisters are so bad she's been on the ice so long. These are amazing images.
It's really quite incredible. Another one that sticks with me is that same little girl riding through the icy streets on the back of her father's bicycle at 3 or 4 in the morning when he would take her from the house to go and skate in this recently built ice arena that no one knew about. And so he would sneak her in through an open window and hold candles so that she could actually skate in the middle of the night to get extra practice time.
You write at one point that in China, quote, the future of the entire family depended on the child rising above the vast, undifferentiated mass of workers. Do the Chinese actually see themselves in their condition that way?
Things are changing so rapidly. I mean, that's, I think, a fairly accurate assessment of a worker's position in an industrial city in China in the period that Shen Shuwei was growing up in the 80s. But, you know, things have changed so rapidly when I was there, and actually the book sort of shows this. Nowadays, the consumer explosion is so profound, it's hard to recognize the old China. So much of the portrait that I paint, you can't actually see in China anymore. It's all the memories and recollections of the people who shared their stories with me.
All of the skaters who've worked long and hard enough to compete at the Olympic level endure injuries. But the worst injury suffered by Yelena Baraznaya was particularly gruesome, and her recovery was absolutely remarkable. Tell us a little about that.
Well, Yelena Baraznaya was one of these children who was taken into the Soviet system at a young age, moved into a dormitory away from her mother, and became really sort of a ward of the state. And in that situation, she was paired with a very abusive young man from Latvia named Oleg Shliakov, who in what was an accident actually ended up kicking her in the head with his skate blade. And this was a traumatic and horrible experience. She ended up having 2 emergency brain surgeries, was temporarily paralyzed, and returned to the ice with a different partner and made it back to the Olympic Games within 2 years. She really needed to have almost a kind of lack of regard for her own well-being to do it.
There would have been considerable drama in the competition involving these 3 pairs, even if there had been no judging controversy in Salt Lake City. The Russian team was trying to preserve an extraordinary winning streak in pair skating. The Chinese team was prepared to attempt a move that no pairs team had ever tried in competition. But the charge that the judging was corrupt drew the attention of folks who might not otherwise have paid any attention to it. Was that perversely beneficial to the sport?
It's so hard to say what the long-term effect will be of that scandal, because it really did draw attention to an important issue, which is that the Olympic Games are not necessarily a level playing field. And that is so wrong. When these athletes give their lives to reach that point, and when they reach that point, they're not judged fairly. But I do think that the scandal detracted in a way from these stories, which was really a shame, because I think these athletes, through their performances, really personify the Olympic ideal. And at a time when the people who run the sport don't live up to the Olympic ideal, these athletes actually make the Olympics special.
So much of the resolution of the charges and countercharges back in 2002 regarding the behavior of the French judge took place behind closed doors. Even folks who watched the Olympics carefully may be unclear on what transpired and how it was resolved. Was there, in fact, a conspiracy to favor the Russian team?
Well, what we know, and actually I had access to transcripts of the ISU's own internal proceedings where they essentially tried the French judge who attracted so much attention for having confessed to voting under pressure for the Russian pair. What I know from those transcripts is that essentially the ISU convicted that judge and her federation president of improper influence in the judging at the Salt Lake City competition. But what was really interesting about that hearing was that the Russians, who were alleged to be on the other side of a French-Russian deal, made no appearance, did not testify, were not brought forward to answer charges. And I find that very peculiar outcome because essentially the French were convicted of making a deal with Russians who were never named, were never present, were never made accountable for what they did. So the story is still unsolved, and it's unsolved mainly because the sports governing body, the International Skating Union, chose not to really pursue those threads. In an incredible development, there was actually an FBI investigation, which you may remember, when officials from the FBI actually discovered that a man named Alimzon Toktokhunov, who was from Uzbekistan, had allegedly conspired with others to fix the Olympic pairs competition, and they had telephone wiretap transcripts that seemed to prove their point. Huh. That evidence could have brought the whole thing into the light, but unfortunately, Toktokhunov was not extradited from Italy, where he was arrested. He apparently got off on a technicality. So that case could still become active again, and we would know the true answer. But essentially, these people have done a very good job of evading the various forms of law that could get them.
You write that none of the four skaters who received gold medals in Salt Lake City was entirely happy with the way things worked out. The Russian skaters, of course, felt the original result should have stood. The Canadians felt ultimately relieved, even more than relieved, exhausted. But, you know, they thought they deserved the gold medal at the time that it was originally awarded. From your perspective, was the awarding of two sets of gold medals a good idea?
It's such a double-edged sword, because if that medal had not been that second set of gold medals had not been awarded, we would probably know today what really happened there. There would have been a thorough investigation. There would have been intensive media pressure to find out what actually transpired. Because the second set of gold medals were awarded, we didn't actually have the satisfaction of having someone get to the bottom of that case. On the other hand, I fail to see what you could have done that would have been fair to both pairs except for give a second gold medal. It's not the athlete's fault that the officiating was corrupt. So I really would have hated to see either pair walk away from that competition without a gold medal because of something that these adults who supervised the sport ended up doing.
Has the judging in pair skating and in figure skating in general become more legitimate as a result of what happened in Salt Lake City, or has what you've essentially described as a cover-up been successful so that things will go along as always?
Well, I can tell you that the two people who were convicted of wrongdoing at that event are serving 3-year suspensions from their sport and will be able to return essentially to those same chairs within 3 years. And that, as a result of the Salt Lake City scandal, the International Skating Union introduced a new judging system in which the panel of judges are essentially anonymous. You can't identify a judge's marks. You can't link those marks to that particular judge. And so judges have even greater freedom from accountability. I think the sport is going in absolutely the wrong direction with the judging. What we need is more accountability, stricter penalties for people who cheat. It's a situation that I think most people would find ludicrous if it was put in place in any other sport. Can you imagine an anonymous official at another professional sports game? It would be kind of ridiculous. But the people who are running this are getting away with it. And I hope for the sake of the athletes that these reforms will not last and that somehow the International Olympic Committee will find a way to intervene and make sure that the next Olympics are not tainted by corruption.
It was heartening to learn that the co-winners of the gold medal at Salt Lake had become good friends, at least as reported in your book. Or is that just good public relations for the ice shows that all four of them skate in together now?
Well, I can tell you that when I interviewed them, they were sharing one of the buses that drive them from show to show, and they had other people they could have shared with. I thought it was a really interesting thing that they had chosen to be together. I mean, really, the athletes don't have anything against each other. I think this is something that when you're at the Olympics, you feel very strongly that there's something that connects the person who finishes last in an event with the person who finishes first. There really is a spirit of international friendship among the athletes, and I'm not surprised that these athletes don't hold it against each other because they've all grown up in this system. They know what judges are capable of, and every person in that system has had an occasion where they got more than they deserved and an occasion where they got less than they deserved. So they have that in common.
Joy Goodwin is the author of The Second Mark, published by Simon & Schuster. She joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Joy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Eight men were banned for life by Major League Baseball for their parts in the 1919 Black Sox scandal. Of those eight, Shoeless Joe Jackson is certainly the most well-known. Cries of "Say It Ain't So, Joe" have echoed down the decades as those convinced of his innocence have made a case for Jackson's reinstatement and induction into the Hall of Fame. But one of Jackson's 1919 teammates is also the focus of a reinstatement campaign, as Greg Eklin reports.
Good morning, SafeWorks Illinois. Jeannie speaking. May I help you?
Dr. David Fletcher is an occupational medicine specialist with a practice in Champaign, Illinois.
Carla, please contact Dr. Fletcher, 212. Amy, please contact Dr. Fletcher, 212.
Dr. Fletcher's passion for baseball is evident here. Souvenirs are strewn about his desk, and pictures of Major League ballparks hang on the walls. And he's passionate about clearing Buck Weaver's name. Weaver was one of the eight members of the 1919 Chicago White Sox banished from the game for fixing the World Series. Weaver was neither as infamous as Shoeless Joe Jackson, nor was he as good a player. The Black Sox scandal was the subject of Elliot Azanoff's Eight Men Out, which made it to the big screen in 1988. But when asked why he's devoted time to clearing Buck Weaver's name, Fletcher cites another movie as his inspiration.
Well, it's sort of a real-life Field of Dreams. I'm sort of like a real-life Ray Kinsella character that instead of a baseball field in the cornfields, this is the real field, the real place, the real crime of the scene, Comiskey Park 1, the parking lot across from U.S. Cellular Field. And just his ghost has just sort of prompted me to do this.
Last year, Fletcher traveled to Kimberling City, Missouri, home of 77-year-old Patricia Anderson. Anderson's father died when she was four, and she was subsequently raised by her uncle, Buck Weaver. Anderson fondly recalls her days growing up on the south side of Chicago, where Weaver continued to live after his banishment.
That was something I remember him taking us in that old Chevy, and he'd put me on his lap, and he'd drive, and he'd sing. And I can't quite remember the words, but he'd always have my name in the song. And I had hold of the wheel while he was driving, and I thought I was driving. And it was the most wonderful thing. I thought my uncle took me in his car, and I drove it, and he sang to me. He had a good voice.
A few months after meeting Anderson, Dr. Fletcher launched a website called clearbuck.com. A rally was held in Chicago last summer in conjunction with baseball's All-Star Game at U.S. Cellular Field. The number of petition signatures since then has steadily grown to 18,000, as has interest in Weaver's story. Anderson contends that's because of the current interest in Pete Rose.
I think, yes, I think that's what it is, bringing it back to people and talking about him. And then when they know about Buck, some of them didn't know about his story and his background. And then they say, well, you know, if they're going to reinstate Rose, they ought to reinstate him and they ought to reinstate Shoeless Joe. A lot of people didn't know too much about what had happened.
According to Azanoff's account in Eight Men Out, Weaver accepted no money, nor was his play in the 1919 World Series anything less than spectacular. According to David Fletcher, the grounds for his banishment were based on his knowledge of what other teammates were doing.
He obviously knew it was happening, but he wasn't sure about the details. He was being true to his teammates. What's also misunderstood is that he wasn't alone. The other so-called clean Sox, like Ray Schlock, Eddie Collins, Dickie Kerr, the manager, they all knew what was going on about this. So he was basically throwing a baseball for, quote, guilty knowledge, but everybody had guilty knowledge. I think that's probably the most misunderstood about him.
To those who ask why Weaver should be reinstated, Anderson's response is simple.
Because he's due. They owe it to him. The man was banished from baseball, never did anything wrong, played his heart out in the series, the World Series, 1919 series. He was a great ball player, and they didn't even give him a second chance. I think everybody has a second chance. He did not throw the series.
From his banishment in 1921 until his death in 1956, Weaver tried in vain to get reinstated. Dr. Fletcher hopes to accomplish it in Patricia Anderson's lifetime. Whether or not it happens, this is how Anderson wants Buck Weaver remembered.
As a great ball player, an honest one, and he should be reinstated long past due to give him his name back. And that's how I want him remembered.
In August, Fletcher will address a court reporters' convention in Chicago on the subject. Then in October, a Black Sox scandal symposium will be held at the Chicago Historical Society. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Champaign, Illinois.
Only a Game's repeated requests for a statement from Major League Baseball regarding Buck Weaver's status went unanswered this week. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the high-whining thrill of radio-controlled car racing. But first, the week's news with Charlie Pierce, who joins us this week from Detroit, where there are no NCAA tournament games in progress. What are you doing in the Motor City?
Oh, I'm pursuing presidential politics.
Oh.
The second most interesting sport.
I'm sorry.
At the moment.
In any case, in NCAA tournament news, the women of college hoops will play their Sweet 16 games today and tomorrow. There have been upsets. Stanford beat Oklahoma, and UC Santa Barbara knocked off Houston, a number three seed. But we're still looking at most of the usual suspects, right?
Yes, this is once again the chalk tournament. The upsets that there have been are interesting, but not very compelling ones. There is a vast great middle to women's basketball, but as there is probably to the men's game at this point. But the national champion is going to come from a group that includes Duke, Tennessee, and probably Connecticut.
You want to make a prediction as far as you've limited to those three?
You know what? I think Duke can win this tournament. And not just because they beat the Marquette Lady Warriors at home the other night, which naturally makes them a superior bunch.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very versatile. And Alana Beard is a terrific player with you know, a way to cap really a marvelous career. So I think they're going to win it.
Meanwhile, can Coach Phil Martelli and his St. Joseph's basketball team thank analyst Billy Packer for inspiring St. Joe's to beat Wake Forest over on the men's side of the tournament on Thursday night?
Well, I think they can thank him for 10 days of really cool hype. But what they can thank for beating Wake Forest is the fact that they played defense very, very well, much better even than I thought they did. They get a lot of credit for their three-point shooting and for the fact they've been together a while, but that is a very good defensive team.
The baseball season begins next week, Charlie.
Oh, no, really?
Yes. It's crept up on you once again.
It crept up on me again. Look at that.
Anyway, the New York Yankees and Tampa Bay Devil Rays have already embarked on the season's longest road trip. I wonder how Commissioner Selig decided which would be the home team when those two play in Tokyo.
I have no idea, but I think it's a great thing to have Major League. I mean, I'm sure the players don't like it very much, and I'm sure that there will be some exhaustion involved, but I think it's just a terrific thing to have baseball played in Tokyo. Thank you.
Tickets are expensive, and sales were very brisk for those Yankees-Devil Rays games. No surprise. I mean, obviously, baseball's been huge in Japan for a long time.
Well, not just that, but the Yankees are bringing, of course, Hideki Matsui home,
mm-hmm.
which is, if you can imagine Michael Jordan having played basketball for a year in, you know, Guam, suddenly coming home to Chicago, you'd sell a lot of tickets, too.
The Toronto Blue Jays are in the tough American League East division with the Yankees, the Red Sox, and the Orioles. And adding to that team's woes is the edict that pitcher Justin Miller will have to wear long sleeves when he pitches because his tattoos are distracting batters. Walter Johnson had a similar problem, as I recall.
Well, as I recall, the original modification of pitcher's clothes to keep them from distracting batter was for them not to wear long sleeves. That people used to wear long white sleeves.
And they used to
uniforms.
Flap.
flat.
And you would not be able to pick up the ball.
Right.
This is a preemptive strike to head off at the pass the inevitable moment when guys come on with tattoos that say things, oh, I don't know, like Ford
or
Gatorade or Nike.
Impeach Bud Selig.
The commissioner must go, exactly.
The Expos, meanwhile, will play 22 of their 81 home games in San Juan this year. But for the third year in a row, the team remains uncertain where its long-term home will be or, in fact, whether it will have one. Would you care to nominate a city or a town for relocation?
Well, you know, I continue. Havana's the only place. You know, there'll have to be a certain change in leadership down there. But as soon as he goes, I predict the casinos and the Expos.
As long as you've brought up Havana, Charlie, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez announced, in addition to crude oil, he will be exporting bowling to Cuba, Creole bowling in this case. Should nations such as our own get busy mastering this sport for the inevitable ideological sports clash to come?
Well, considering that our nation attempted to export Hugo Chavez a few months back, I think this is a promising development. I am unsure, even with my longstanding and devotion to the kegling life, I'm not real sure what Creole bowling is. I mean, do you knock over, like, bottles of Tabasco sauce?
Well, this is the great thing about sports. There's always something new on the horizon. Just
apparently,
stay with
it's something
it.
Like bocce.
Meanwhile, Mr. NASCAR, there are apparently some clouds over the country's allegedly fastest-growing sport. Why is sponsorship getting harder for even the star drivers to come by?
Well, I think in a sluggish economy, companies are less likely to spend a lot of money on doing things like sponsoring NASCAR. And I think there was probably a ceiling on its explosive growth over the last 4 or 5 years. And I think you're right about now reaching it. It's only a matter of time before we're back to, you know, Skoll and Royal Oak Charcoal.
The National Football League will penalize flamboyant, pre-planned celebrations this season with an automatic 15-yard penalty. Fines weren't working. Players were continuing to celebrate. How will the league determine premeditation, though?
Well, I think the cell phones and the Sharpies are probably out. But it's interesting that the National Football League is going all these lengths to restrict pre-planned celebrations in the end zone when the FCC is going to such lengths to restrict pre-planned celebrations at halftime.
What I would like to know is, how come the poobah in the National Football League who announced this change started out his speech by saying, don't call us the no-fun league? Why shouldn't we?
Watch us. We're having lots of fun. We're keeping people from doing things. That's fun.
Finally, Charlie, in an attempt to develop baseball players for the 2008 Summer Olympics, host China has called upon Sun Wukong, the mythical Monkey King, and his magical staff. You think this will work?
Wait a minute now. Let's see. Which way do I go? Do I make jokes about the Monkey King or do I make jokes about the magical staff? Well, the FCC being what it is, I'll go with the Monkey King.
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, joins our magical staff each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
My comments last week about team mascots and nicknames provoked considerable consternation. From New London, Connecticut, New Haven, Vermont, Albany, New York, and London, England came outrage that I'd identified the teams of Campbell College as the only Fighting Camels. Margaret Carruthers, Scott Kaplan, Bill and Debbie McDowell, and Quentin Walker all brought to my attention that Connecticut College's teams are also the Camels. Thank you all for that correction. Catherine Devine was upset that the list of unusual mascots lacked the University of Santa Cruz banana slugs. Ms. Devine, who hears only a game on WEOS in Geneva, New York, was especially disappointed that we had missed the opportunity to play one of her favorite fight songs, Banana Slugs Racing Down the Field by the Austin Lounge Lizards. Brian Avery, who hears us on WFYI in Indianapolis, wrote to make sure that my next list of excellent mascots and nicknames included the Crookville, Ohio Ceramics. Their chant, Mr. Avery reports, is, "Our plate won't chip." Carol C. Williams, a WBUR listener, wrote to alert us to the teams representing Poca, West Virginia. They're called the Polka Dots. And John Remy, who listens to WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, wrote, quote, "Years ago, when I went to college in Omaha, Nebraska, Benson High School's teams were called the Bunnies. I checked their website this morning, and I found that they are now called the Mighty Bunnies. Mary Momross, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany, New York, has been irritated by some of our recent basketball coverage. When you talked about the NCAA tournament, the brackets, and so on, it was clear that you were talking about the men's game, she wrote. Why is it that the men's games are simply the tournament and the women's games are the women's tournament? I had hoped Only a Game might remember that women in sports aren't some kind of bizarre exception to the default male athlete. If you have a complaint, a question, or a word of encouragement, you can reach us via our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. The postman will deliver to us letters addressed to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Banana slugs, racing down the field, banana slugs, partially congealed banana slugs, leaping for the dump, banana slugs, oozing lots of spunk, never showing fear.
Hey, banana beer!
Slide, 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 slather you with slime. With another time, banana slugs! Hear our battle cry, shrivel up and die!
On a recent sunny Saturday afternoon, while countless full-sized cars crawl from mall to mall, half a dozen radio-controlled cars are indoors, tearing around a carpeted oval in Radical Rick's Race City in Swansea, Massachusetts. For David Bridgewater, the proprietor of Radical Rick's, the establishment is a great big, buzzing, whining, video-filled dream come true. Bridgewater established Radical Rick's for family as well as business reasons.
I was managing a bicycle products company and working where I was in a position that I didn't see my children a lot, and I enjoyed the opportunity to look at my life and say, how can I not only work in a business but have my children involved in it? And even though they're only 3 and 5 years old, I actually call my younger son the head of marketing here because he gives me all the ideas. True story.
What are you going to do if they get a little older and they come down here and they say, no, Dad, this is stupid. I'd rather go play golf or something.
Well, then I got to put some golf driving ranges within the building to keep them going. But whatever it takes, you know, it's a daily challenge, as all parents know.
Well, let's go over here and see what's going on, okay? Tell me what I've described this for me.
Yeah. What you're seeing is this is our supersized oval. It's 275-foot center line. This heat has 5 gentlemen racing in it. I'd say out of this crew here, we have 3 of the top 5 racers in the country.
These racers operate cars that are about 1/10 scale, meaning they are about 1 foot long. They can circle the carpet track at 50 miles an hour. They are fiery red, blazing orange, midnight black. They are covered with decals of car care products, not to mention numbers, flames, and monsters. The racers themselves are mostly male. In fact, the only women in evidence at the U.S. Open Carpet Oval Championship of radio-controlled cars on this day are nibbling French fries and rolling their eyes at the antics of their husbands, boyfriends, or sons, some of whom are dressed for competition. Their jackets bear the logos of the companies that supply them with pinions and gears, tires and batteries. Brett Lund, who drove to Swansea from Albany, New York, leads the league in logos. I catch up with him as he steps off the raised platform where the racers stand to do the actual remote driving while the race is still going on. Brett Lund's car has mysteriously come to a silent halt. He's trying to figure out how to ready it for another heat, though he doesn't seem especially discouraged. I ask him what constitutes a great weekend of racing.
Not crashing. If I can go out there without crashing and just race around, it's a good time. A lot of good people around here. You just have fun. You know, winning is icing on the cake.
How long have you been doing this?
Oh, 18 years.
Wow.
Yeah, a long time.
And as long as it says Health Quest on your jersey here, your wife is okay with that?
That's right.
Does she participate in this sport?
No, she races dogs.
Real dogs, yes. Though, not little mechanical dogs.
No, real dogs, not radio controlled.
During a break between races, I wander into what's known as the pit area, a big, noisy warehouse of a room behind the brightly lit track. There, at what looks like an extremely well-equipped electronics bench, Sean Cochran is attempting to patch up his car.
Oh, I had a little battle damage and trying to glue my bumper back together here. This is pretty minor damage, so I just figured I'd fix it. But if it was really, really bad, you could just switch to another car. It wouldn't be a problem.
No problem for Sean Cochran, at least. He works for one of the companies that makes the radio-controlled racing cars. He's traveled all the way from Costa Mesa, California, to show his wares, as well as demonstrate his expertise. I ask him if most of the competitors are frustrated NASCAR drivers who secretly, or not so secretly, wish they could climb into the much bigger, much noisier, much more expensive machines running at places like Daytona and Indianapolis.
I'm sure they all do. That's part of the fantasy of doing this, is that you get to be the star driver.
Big smiles, everybody. Big smiles. Come on, smiles. Come on, smile, guys. There you go.
Back at trackside, 10 or 12 youngsters between the ages of 10 and 16 are being photographed for a magazine devoted to radio-controlled car racing.
All right, come on, guys. One big smile for the magazine. Get the magazine. Get the school and show all your classmates.
Just before the youngsters' race is set to begin, the car belonging to a fellow named Jeff ceases to whir. A middle-aged man rushes onto the track and begins fiddling with the stricken machine. I ask him, what's up?
Well, the kids all had to do a motor change, put a spec motor in there today, and they're panicking over this big racing, so forgot to tighten up his pinion screw. The motor was turning, just wasn't putting no power to the gears, to the wheel, so he was panicking. We ran in the back, grabbed one off of my car, and stuck it in there.
What's your name?
Radical Rick.
You're Radical Rick?
Yep. Oh,
splendid. Okay, so you're the man who puts this whole thing together.
Well, I'm the man behind the man, I guess.
And we're off and running our youth division here at Radical Rick's.
Thanks to the efforts of Radical Rick himself, the race goes off more or less on schedule.
Well, we got a wreck coming off of turn number two.
Eventually, a hotshot named Stephen Farrell wins. Jeff, the kid over whose car Radical Rick himself has labored, doesn't. And though it's a tough time for young Jeff, I approach him and his mom to find out what went wrong.
Tell me a little bit about what went on in that race. What was the difference between...
Battery went dead and I lost.
Spending it since 11 o'clock, you figure he would charge the battery.
This may not be quite the parent-child bonding experience that David Bridgewater had in mind when he established Radical Rick's, but at least nobody got hurt, and Jeff and his mom assure me that he'll be back, better prepared and wiser for his experience, to race another day.
Radio, live transmission. Radio, live transmission.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for our newsletter or learn more about the Second Mark and Skategate 2002, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from RC race car official Chad Sewell.
Well, they're toy cars. You know, at the end of the day, you're driving your real car home.
Well, yeah, unless you're really small. With apologies to Stuart Little and to E.B. White, I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.